Welcome to Business Watch, where we're putting the week into perspective. And we saw the Rand breaking a two-day losing streak yesterday as investors welcomed the medium-term budget policy statement, staging a mild recovery after falling the most in more than 8 months in the previous session on inflation fears. The JSE and local bonds were also heartened by the statement. Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana outlining a better fiscal position in his maiden medium-term budget and saying that he would continue the fiscal consolidation outlined by his predecessor Tito Mboweni in an effort to reduce the budget deficit and stabilise South Africa's high debt. And we saw Asian share prices advancing in early trade this morning as that shock from a surprisingly strong US inflation reading ebbed, with investors now hopeful that the worst price hikes could be soon over. Well, to put things into perspective, I'm joined by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mklunga, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Warwick, let's start with the global picture here. In US stock futures were up around a third of a percent this morning after a mixed session on Thursday when we saw the S&P 500 ending flat, while the Nasdaq was on the march up by around half a percent, I think it was. But the world stock prices have posted their biggest fall in over a month this week following that US CPI number. It did come a lot hotter than many had anticipated, 6.2%. That's the strongest since November of 1990. When do we start conceding that inflation is more sticky than first hoped?
Michael, I think we start conceding the point when expectations and outcomes start significantly deviating. At this stage, I can't really say that that what is materializing is that significantly different from what was guided by the Fed. I mean, obviously, it is, they can give some reasonable indications. But it's a question, first of all, of scale. How big are the numbers? But of course, when the numbers are noisy, it's statistical as much as anything else. However, when the duration continues to be much longer than was guided and initially forecast in markets, I think that's when you start getting twitchy. So at this point, I mean, there's not enough to really start acting on and saying, oh dear, we need to run screaming from the room. It's more a case of, well, we've got to actually see how this unravels. I mean, supposedly now this was the peak point. And I think that's the first thing is, will that prove to be the case? And then secondly, let's see what the flattening of that inflation curve look like. Because obviously with interest rates at close to zero and inflation at 6.2, those twain definitely need to meet. So the question now, of course, is how is the path drawn out by which they meet?
At least we are seeing some of those supply chain issues. The Baltic Dry Index has seemingly rolled over and it's coming down again. And we've seen key input costs declining in various commodity markets, iron ore, Dalian futures down. And we've seen the coal price certainly crash over the last while, lumber prices as well. But if you look at where interest rates are going around the world, a number of emerging markets hiking rates, the Czech Republic, Polish rates, Brazilian rates, Russian rates, Hungary, New Zealand, Mexico, all hiking in the last 6 weeks. So it does raise a question here, I guess, and maybe Isa, you can pick up on this one, on whether or not we'll see our own central bank following suit before we touch on this budget.
I think just maybe to pick up where Warwick ended up, Carmen Reinhart, the chief economist of the World Bank and the vice president, put up some statistics that might indicate perhaps inflation is no longer transitory, but is going towards maybe persistent. 55% of advanced economies have inflation of above 5%. That is relative to their implicit target of 2%. About 35% of emerging markets and developing economies have inflation of about 5%. And then you have a 7% of EMs that have inflation of about 40%. That is now higher from a 0% in 2011. So if you just take all those, it might say maybe we need to take a bit of a of a reassessment and say maybe the inflation is no longer transitory. There's a huge chance that it's going to be persistent, which is why we are seeing emerging markets starting to hike rates. They started early in the year already. And for us, while inflation might be moving to persistent elsewhere in the world, we still don't have an inflation problem. The budget just showed yesterday they forecast 4.5% this year. But if over the medium term, a 4.3% on average. The same with the sub, roughly around the midpoint of 4.5%. So if we do rate hikes come through, it would not necessarily to control inflation as they see it in their own models, but to adjust to tightening financial conditions globally. Let's hope we don't see a currency depreciation over the next couple of years that might import some of the global inflation locally. But for now, I'm not convinced we need an aggressive hiking cycle to respond to inflation because it's still quite muted, still within the midpoint. Inflation expectations are still anchored at the midpoint.
And we certainly are not seeing that come through in demand in any kind of shape or form in this economy. And that's important to bear in mind here. As we turn our attention now to that all-important medium-term budget policy statement, and I must just add, I felt it got drowned out a little yesterday, Raymond, by the news of the passing of F.W. de Klerk. We're going to be addressing that in more detail in next week's show, but certainly our condolences are with his family at the moment. How would you best describe this mini-budget? Raymond, from what we've seen delivered?
Well, I think, Michael, if we're going to react to the mini-budget yesterday, I just would caution at the outset that you must look at both the speech and at the review. There is an economic review, a very substantial one, which is added to the budget speech. And I think when one reacts, one has to pick up the nuances that may not have been in the speech but are in the review. That said, I think we must also remind ourselves that this was the first budget of a new minister, and he obviously is feeling his way, and it's not the main budget. And it's clear from some of the decisions that were postponed that this isn't the main budget and that we have to wait for some of them in the month of February. I like the editorial, which was in Business Day today, where the headline said, "The right noises, no surprises, spot on from the script." I think that sums it up pretty well. And I think what it tells me is that our public finances are in a safe pair of hands. This is a well-experienced minister who is going to be very careful about what he does. And secondly, it is inevitably, to some extent, what I'd call a sort of holding operation, in the sense that there's a snapshot picture which looks quite good, because I think, for example, if you take that 120 billion extra revenue, two-thirds of it's going towards debt reduction, there's a commitment to fiscal sustainability, there's realism in the assumptions, although we may come back to that later. And I think the important point here is that there's a recognition that some of the good news that is reflected in the mini budget is temporary, and that we really have to invest in certain other things in order to see that not only do we have sustainable fiscal stability, but we also need sustainable growth. And that's another issue that we need to look at. Once we get past being mesmerized by the 5% growth that we're having this year, we know there are special factors behind it. It's a rebound. And so it's a question of how are our policies, including our fiscal policies, going to invest in sustainable job-rich growth? And I'm hoping that we'll unpack that in the course of our discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. And Warwick, just to get your initial reaction to the budget, what the finance minister did say in response to how he's different from his predecessor yesterday to journalists in the lockup was, well, that he's got slightly better shoes than Tito Mboweni. And I suppose the market will be watching whether or not he can walk that line of holding firm on what he said around keeping a firm hand on expenditure, especially in the wake of this windfall. What stood out for you?
I think for me, the political implications are quite important. And it's very simply this. Up until Mboweni went, I mean, the implication across the board was that Imbeweni was a maverick aberration. He was unusual. He was out running outside the tram lines of the ANC, blah, blah, blah. And I think what this goes to show is that, in fact, it was very much ANC policy all the time. Godongwana is simply carrying out what Imbeweni started. Imbeweni was a brave man who basically spent all of his political capital and took a lot of knives in the back and chest and everywhere else in getting this improving framework going. And Godongwana is the guy who's now going to do the work of execution of carrying these plans out without worrying about spending his political capital. But at the same time, he had a lot more political capital to start with, and he's the guy that can actually carry the ball across the goal line, given sufficient time.
I think that's a deeply important point, given the context, Isa, in which this budget takes place, and how much people used to criticize Tito Mboweni for being too conservative, for being this austere finance minister who didn't care about the poor. I think the finance minister yesterday was at pains to point out that this is a very socially minded budget. Almost two-thirds of what we spend goes to social expenditure.
Absolutely, Michael. I think let me say 2 points. One of the statements the finance minister said was, this is a government budget, not a national treasury budget, because it is negotiated with ministers from different departments, and ultimately cabinet takes the decision. So that moves away from the attacks that somehow national treasury is anti-poor, it doesn't care about improving employment in the country, which is quite incorrect to if we look at it, because the self-interest of national treasury is to make everyone a millionaire so they can tax them and not having to worry about tax collections. So the idea that they are anti-poor itself is not affirmed by basic economics of self-interest. Secondly, if we look at Minister Godongwana, it's possibly the longest intern for the finance minister's job than any of the ministers we've had, given his experience in the ANC as the head of the Economic Transformation Committee for more than a decade, from the trade unions as well, and also just recently as the chair of the DBSA, where he had to confront issues of infrastructure. That before he became finance minister, which means he understands a lot of what needs to be done, given the places that he have been. That's why, to affirm Professor Pearson's point, to say we are in good hands, steady hands, and this is good going forward. We are not going to get things that are too radical that are going to rock the boat.
I just want to add that his new nickname might be Enoch Tough Love Godongwana, because he seems to be preaching this sort of tough love stance.
I'd like to come back to this point, if I can use this image of the snapshot picture. I think the fact that we're spending 60% of our non-interest expenditure on the so-called social wage is necessary in the socio-economic circumstances of South Africa. But if you move out of the snapshot picture, that's not a good message, because in fact, we want to move people out of welfare into work. The only way you do that is to get this economy moving. I know we've said it often, but it looks like it can't be said often enough. We've got to get the growth rate up, and it's got to be inclusive, and it's got to be job rich with all the other things that need to support it. That's point number one. And point number two is the point which ISA made, that the message was put over that this is a government budget. That doesn't just mean making the books balance. It means implementing what is implicit in the budget speech and the things that are not in the budget speech which need to be implemented. So what we need to get out of this collaborative message that this is a government budget is that the implementation risks have to be reduced, not just by the National Treasury or by Operation Vulindlela, but by the cabinet and the public sector. That's a commitment which is going to make a difference to the future numbers one way or another. Because like Eskom, the National Treasury is working on very narrow margins. If something goes wrong, metaphorically speaking, the lights will go off. So it's very important that we get this economy moving and that in the main budget, we see tangible decisions that enable us to make a more reliable judgment call on some of the numbers and on which we need to build a moving, growing economy that makes a difference to everyone.
Isa, when we look at the economic growth projections, it's almost as if government doubts that their reform initiatives will be fast and efficient enough to support higher and more sustainable growth, because government keeps on talking about reforms and transformation to get the economy going, yet the average GDP forecast for the next 3 years is a meager 1.7%. And at that number, we would be underperforming compared to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, our emerging market peer group, and barely keeping up with population growth. What do you make of the growth projections in the budget?
Firstly, if we look at the 5% for this year, it's on consensus. That's not much of a discussion point. Much of the year is already gone anyway. The impact of load shedding is already factored into that. The third wave, July riots, already into that forecast. So it's not much of a discussion. A number of two things that really help that 5%, commodity prices and base effects. Those two things are not going to be there next year. That's why we see an economic growth that reduces to below 2% over the medium term. But to your point on economic reforms relative to the growth forecast, I think if you are a national treasury who is not an implementing agent for most of the economic reforms, you want to budget on the basis of current economic policy that is in place. And the current economic policy that is in place is not a 3 or 4% economic growth type of policies. There are less than 2% economic growth type of policies. The ones which they have in the budget, which are geared for implementation in 2022, those are the reforms that can lift economic growth. So wait until you see the implementation by other departments in government, then you can update forecasts. Once you have seen the boost in confidence and the boost in private sector investment, which they bring, then it opens room for a potential, overperformance or an improvement in the fiscus, which is going to give you a leeway to implement some of the expenditure items that you want to do.
And Warwick, I think of this windfall that we got from the commodities boom that we've experienced, 120 billion. And then I imagine what we could have done had we actually got our policy ducks in a row in terms of the MPRDA and the binding constraints of power supply and Eskom and labor policy and all of those other issues. And we must be obviously very grateful of this this mining bonanza. But again, I think we've probably under-collected versus our real potential in South Africa, and that really has to be the bottom line here.
Very much so, Michael. I mean, it got said in the past that South Africa tended to advance economically by windfall and politically by disaster. But I think, when we look at South Africa, I mean, as the global economy evolves, and as our economy evolves as well, the commodity windfalls are going to get smaller and smaller as we become as they become less relevant in our economy. And of course, we have constrained the size of commodities in our economy anyway, more by malign neglect than anything else. So clearly, some reforms required there. You mentioned Eskom. The other one, of course, is Transnet. Part of the boom was iron ore, and the iron ore from South Africa is choked along a single rail line. So there's lots more that can be done, and of course then there's the whole issue of coal exports as well. So in transitioning to a broader economy than just a commodity economy, we actually need to change our whole model of economic stewardship. In order to achieve this. And if we don't, well, we're certainly going to snatch the future from ourselves. Obviously, we have an overhead constraint in the form of Eskom and others. If we can improve policy, but if the economy actually fired too hard, we might have we might struggle in other areas as we run into the power overhead. And that highlights another problem of South Africa. We have a capital allocation problem in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the huge binding constraints. But at least we are seeing movement with regards to Transnet, for example, opening up the rail infrastructure to third parties, but only by a deadline in this mini-budget of the end of 2023. It was first identified in a Treasury paper some years ago, and you know, by that stage it'll be like 5 years since the binding constraint was identified to actually implementing. Raymond, that comes back to a point we've made on the show in the past. There just isn't the sense of urgency inside government to move fast enough on the economy.
Yes, well, I think that is a common theme that's run through all the debates, and I think one also, in a sense, felt that yesterday there wasn't enough of a sense of urgency, but I think one can understand the circumstances. One hopes that in the main budget there will be more of a sense of urgency. I think one of the problems here is that we've allowed bottlenecks which occur in any country to become ceilings, and we don't get the solution. Bottlenecks can be resolved with or without the private sector, but if you allow something like a ceiling, like for example Eskom, that's a ceiling. It's very difficult to get round it. You then have to make structural changes, and you have to invest them with a sense of urgency. I would just make the point, interestingly, for those who have long memories, it's interesting that on the 24th of January 2008, when the lights went out for the first time, we were growing at 5%. It's a coincidence that we happen to be growing at 5% now, and the lights have gone out again. Which shows there is a ceiling here. It's not just a bottleneck, it's a ceiling. And we need to find ways, creative, urgent ways. So I come back to the point that when we get to the investment conference, which was postponed, I think rightly, to March, you will have had the mini budget, the State of the Nation address, the main budget. You'd better have a credible and positive message to put to that investment conference, which you are able to do. The ingredients are there. But we've got to bring it together in such a way as to say that here is the way ahead. This is how we're going to do better than 1.7%, and this is how we're going to do it, and we're inviting you to participate in helping us to achieve that. And I think that if we can bring that message over in March, then we can make some of those numbers look a lot better on the growth front and make the fiscal numbers look less vulnerable.
And Isa, I would argue that one of the main ingredients, if you're going to be selling South Africa as an investment destination at that conference next year, is to have a credible plan around Eskom, apart from the obvious in the roadmap and the unbundling, but Eskom's balance sheet. And so the news yesterday that the government is now looking to sell potentially power stations to private investors is interesting, and I would have to say very welcome at this stage. Some might say, who wants a 40-year-old coal-fired power station? I know many in the private sector who reckon they could probably get another 20 years of life out of some of them. What do you make of the news?
Look, I think it's very interesting news, but I'm not sure to what extent it's going to come with a solution for the 400 billion rand in debt, much of which is guaranteed by the state. So any solution, even when we look at the broader energy transition from coal to green energy or to renewable energy, any solution that does not address the 400 billion rand of Eskom, but also the 115,000 people directly going to be impacted by that transition, is not going to be to work. So we still need a lot more detail on how exactly it's going to be structured.
Well, when the idea was first mooted a couple of years ago, I think the number attached to these assets was that could potentially be sold was between 400 and 450 billion odd. I mean, that seems to solve the Eskom balance sheet crisis if we see that level of asset sales executed.
I think some of that would be an overinflation of the assets, because I think a big part of that would include the cost price of Kasili and Medupi, which were clearly implemented at well over market price, and obviously then have resulted firstly in the big debt on the Eskom balance sheet, but also an inflated value on the Eskom balance sheet. I would have said that probably the net value of PPE on Eskom balance sheet in total, I think we'd be lucky if it's up to 300 billion, frankly, Michael. But I mean, your point about asset realization there, nonetheless, I mean, is valid. I mean, there must be more that can be done, and I mean, more dynamic management be found. I mean, yes, I think André de Ruyter is doing a great job at Eskom, but I dare say that he is finding himself constrained continually by the dead hand of politicians. And what we actually need to do is liberate the few capable people that government has, get rid of the cadres, and liberate competent managements to competently manage.
Well, that's why we do await Justice Zondo's report and what he has to say on cadre deployment with bated breath. Where is it due by the end of the year? Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, who's joined around the table by Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mplanga, Chief Economist at Alex Forbes, running the rule over yesterday's mini budget.